Welcome to Champagne Problems Podcast. I am your host, Robbie Shaw. Join us as we explore mental and emotional well-being, physical optimization, and the journey to discovering your highest self. Champagne Problems is brought to you in proud partnership with Bond Buzz, the alcohol-free social spirit. Bond Buzz is an award-winning, alcohol-free functional beverage company creating adult drinks that are health-forward, all-natural, and uncompromising. They're on a mission to create a future where feeling good and getting buzzed exist in absolute harmony and not at the expense of your health. Their bold concoctions offer focus and energy while calming the nervous system for a night on the town or a productive afternoon. Bond Buzz uses only natural ingredients and a hyperfunctional blend of nootropics, adaptogens, and functional mushrooms to amplify the sensory experience. If you're looking for a drink to help you cool off after work or a drink to stimulate your mind and body without the harmful, icky hangovers, drink Bond Buzz for good days only. Welcome back, my friends. Today, Patrick will be leading the conversation with our hometown friend, Michael Stutz. Michael's coming in to share about his experience a couple years ago where he found himself committed in a psych institution. As you will see, Michael is extremely open and honest and funny about his life's twists and turns. He's also developed an ongoing passion to normalize mental health conversations inside conference rooms, corner offices, and boardrooms of high-stress environments. We are honored to have Michael in here today as he is creating value in his experience and establishing community among those who so deeply relate to him. Let's go to Michael.
Michael Stutz, welcome to Champagne Problems.
It is an honor to be here. This is Charlotte royalty right here. You guys are this is what it's all about.
You made it.
I have been so pumped to have you on, man. You know, we connected, what, probably reconnected, what, 2.5, 3 years ago?
I can tell you with certainty it was late May, early June of 2022.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, yeah, man. And then, you know, we've been kind of in touch the last several months or so since you went public with your book. And I'm working my way through it. I was hoping I'd get to finish it before you came on, but... But yeah, man, really pumped that you're here in the flesh.
Should we just stop this and watch you finish reading it?
Yeah, sure. Just I'll just read, sure, it
yeah,
read it out loud.
And you can maybe narrate it. Yeah,
you can chime in.
Sure. Yeah, I'll do a live reading right now. Yeah. Great. Everyone will love that.
But there's. I have to ask you this question. Yeah. I was thinking about it. So like, when I crack this thing and in the first page, it says, "This list has absolutely nothing to do with the topic at hand, though it would be happy to discuss this further. It's a pretty good indicator of how my brain works." And it says, "One, I remember all kinds of stuff in great detail, even if sometimes I don't want to." And that was one of the things that made me laugh out loud in bed the other night and woke up my wife. Because that was like one of the things that I remembered about you from high school. And I wanted to ask you, because I don't remember much of high school. What do you remember?
Unfortunately, I remember a lot.
Yeah.
I remember that. I remember there was a lot of anxiety and a lot of pressure at Charlotte Country Day School.
Yeah.
Where we went. That's just, you know, big shout out.
Good.
Yeah. It's really weird. To this day, I have dreams where I don't know what class is next. So I remember the schedule and how ridiculous it was.
Yeah, yeah.
And how we had a 7-day rotating schedule and we had the fat block in the second period. It is just wild how that is still embedded in my brain to the point that I have dreams about it on pretty much a weekly basis.
The digital printouts of that. And I remember, yeah, I had to like look at it all year.
Yep.
To remember what classes I had.
Last day of class. Well, yeah, what's next?
Yeah, exactly.
I also remember taking a class called Internet in 1996.
I don't remember.
No, Internet was, it was a fad back then that never really took off, I don't think. But yeah, we wrote HTML in this class. And I remember thinking, this is completely useless information.
Yeah.
I really better study my, you know, physics class.
Yeah.
I really understand the ins and outs of calculus. But That internet class, man, if I had really stuck to that, we'd be having a very different conversation right now. But one really big thing I remember is Mr. Kelly.
Oh, yeah.
The late Mr. Kelly, who a lot of us who went to Country Day had, he had a little saying that I still remember every time I go into a meeting. If you thoroughly master the material, you will do well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I use that literally every time I go into a big presentation or whatever.
Yeah. He was a special human
preparation.
Being.
There's a lot of stuff I also remember that, you know, maybe some of the folks don't want to be talked about.
Yeah. We'll leave it.
Do you have a photographic memory?
I do not. No. And I only remember unimportant things.
Right.
I can't remember really, really important stuff. But if it's, you know, what somebody was wearing the day that, you know, I was doing the speech contest, you know, I got. Yeah.
Have you figured out why that is?
No.
Because I try to figure that out. There are things that I remember, and then, of course, there's names of the person that I met yesterday I cannot remember, but I can remember very useless other stuff. Why? What am I doing in that moment that makes it stick?
The best guess that I have, and this is what's... all right, so I thought you were going to ask me my special talent.
Sorry.
I thought you were going to ask me the special talent of reverse order every college basketball national championship.
Yeah, that was...
Oh, he reeled them off before you got here.
I'm not doing that on the on live. Yeah. I might. but I remember things that are associated with other senses.
Yeah.
So I can remember... The reason I can remember all those basketball championships is for a long time, it was because I studied the World Almanac, and I can remember the actual page. I can see the page of the World Almanac. Then later in life, I remember where I was when I was watching each game, and then there's some... you know, attachment to that memory. That's the best guess I have. But if I'm just reading something in a book, sometimes it doesn't really land.
I remember playing basketball with you. You got a good jumper. You had a nice... I remember I used to... We'd play a little bit here and there, and you had to dish it off to you in the corner. And
corner athletics.
Bucket.
Athletics were not really the strong suit.
But yeah, you're a good shooter.
I could throw the discus, that's for sure.
And
I remember... I took a year off of basketball. So I really was a big, you know, basketball player. Yeah. I enjoyed it. But then I think in 10th grade, I didn't play. And I lifted weights instead. And I went back out on the court and shot the ball over the basket.
Yeah.
And from then on, the yips set in.
Too much.
It was not until my little trip to the place I went a few years ago that I picked a basketball up again. I was like, all right, we're going to do this.
Yeah.
We're gonna get the mechanics back. Yeah. Like 40% of them came back.
So, dude, let's break it down, man. Let's go back, like, you know, I mean, we got some time. So, like, I want to give you some time. I don't want you to give away everything in the book, but, because I want people to read it. But, tell us, where do we start, man?
Yeah. I think the place to start is that in, just call it generally the early 2020s, I had what appeared to be a pretty good life. I'd spent a lot of time in the professional world, had been fortunate to, you know, be successful, and was in a big executive job at a big company that owns a lot of restaurants. Still live in the same, but nice house, great friends. And on March 31st, 2022, I made a decision that this wasn't really a place I needed to be anymore, and that I had so much shame and so much feeling of losing myself, and I didn't see a way back. And so I started getting some really nasty thoughts, and ended up going to a place, an inpatient mental health facility, sometimes called a psych ward, per the title of the book. I did make one stop before I went there. I went to the Final Four and watched UNC beat Duke. So some things you just can't miss.
You got that live.
Yeah. So, it's rude to talk about Carolina beating Duke in the Final Four, but also in Cameron before that. Yeah, it's a big sign of disrespect to Coach K and all Duke fans that Tar Heels won that game. So I think the starting point is, how does a guy who seems like there's a lot going on in his life and a lot of really positive things, has a great family, came from a, you know, great city, great, you know, education. How do you go from there to there? And you wake up, you know, in the blank walls of a psych ward. And the reason this book exists is because I came home with nothing to do, no sports on TV, needed something to sort of process all of this. So I wrote it all out and just documented how did that happen. And it was really just for myself. But then I thought maybe some other people, high achieving types, people of privilege who maybe feel like there's no reason for them to have problems in their life, but we all do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mental health challenges don't discriminate. So yeah, I found out through all the work that I was doing that so much of how I ended up there in 2022 had to do with things that happened in 1986, 1987. And that's why the theme of the book, the visuals, the chapter titles, everything links back to this moment in my life in literally 1987.
Purple Rain?
Yeah, you know, Purple Rain was a big influence. But yeah, that was a big one. It actually is the Purple Rain font, I'm told. Also the Teen Wolf font.
Yeah. That's what I recognize.
Either way. So yeah, and there's obviously a lot of time between 1987 and 2022, but that's what this explores, and I released it to the world to just try to help people. It's a scary thing to do, but I believe that it's worth it.
Yeah. I mean, I you know, that's what really drew me to you was your, you know, vulnerability and your courage to really kind of make this public, man. And I think, you know, my recovery journey's been, I've tried to be as open and honest as I can about it since I started, and you know, none of my stuff was ever a secret, really. Or it was pretty clear that I was struggling for a long time. But the you know, I think it's a lot harder for people that have mental health issues, because it sometimes, especially, you know, guys like you that are high achieving, that have, you know, pretty high level jobs, it has to be contained. And I really think, and I can tell you this from my own personal experience, you're going to help so many more people than you ever expected through this book and through your, you know, willingness to share your story, and really put this out to the world.
I hope so. And in fact, it's, if anybody wants it and doesn't want to pay for it, I'm happy. I send PDFs of it to people.
Yeah.
It's not about, this isn't about me becoming an author. Let me be clear on something. I am not an author. I did write a book. I'm not even really that into books. The last two books I read were Dave Grohl's book and Duff McKagan's book. So it's not exactly like literary horsepower that I'm shooting for here.
It's pretty damn good.
Both books are excellent. You know, shout out to those guys. But the other thing is, I'm not really a mental health warrior. I'm not someone that's running around saying, you know, life can be puppies and rainbows if only you meditate and breathe some. I'm telling people life is effing hard. I know I can cuss, but you know, dignified.
Nice hold.
Life is hard. If you don't have some anxiety and stress, you're probably not doing enough.
It's coming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's coming. Like you can numb your way out of those things, but they are absolutely inevitable.
Sure.
Death taxes and you know, anxiety and stress.
It's suffering.
Right. And I'm also not here to say that mental health can be used as an excuse to fall short on your duties of life. And if that means your academics, if it means your sports, if it means your family, it's not something you should say like, oh, I don't have to do those things because I'm stressed or because I'm not feeling myself right now. What I am here to say is there are ways to address some challenges that you have, not ignore them for 25 years or 30 years, whatever it was for me, but actually recognize it, manage it, and then take on stress and anxiety with a different perspective.
Yeah.
So, and I'm still an executive and I'm still trying to, you know, move forward and move up in the world. So this is really something meant to help me or any others who are in the same kind of boat.
So a common theme in a lot of our conversations with various guests is around pain and discomfort and the suffering that comes along with life, inevitably. And often we have people like you, like us, where it it boils and boils and boils, and then an event occurs that yep. makes us go, holy shit, there was, I had a lot going on and I didn't know.
Yep.
Maybe I did know and I didn't want to deal with it. I've been pushing it and, you know, pushing it and pushing it. And I think that is a very common theme in our society, just human nature. Like, yeah. who likes pain? Yeah. Who likes suffering? Who likes discomfort? Nobody. So we live in a world where it's very easy to push that stuff down, to self-soothe, to deny, whatever it is. And the message really that I'm hearing is, don't do that, yeah. right?
Yeah.
But how do you not do that? That's right. the thing. It's like often it takes this event, this intervention to create the awareness and what we're trying to do. And it sounds like what you and all of us want to share our experiences to just try to get out ahead of it.
Yeah. And what I found interesting, especially meeting lots of people when I was at the place I went and since, everyone has a different flavor of how they cope with things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And some of the more straightforward versions are drugs and alcohol.
Right.
And my alcohol played a part in my journey, but mine was much more stay moving, stay doing things, do things even if it's painful to you to avoid some other kind of pain. So specifically for me, I had these root issues. I do have a brain chemistry that I believe is different than others, the serotonin stuff, whatever, not a doctor. But I also had experiences at a young age that built some insecurity in my life. I mean, the classic parental divorce, nope. you know, that happens to lots of people, but that's not the reason that all this happened. But
it's
it's a factor, but the real factor that got me was my brain remembers a lot of stuff, but it also has a way of manufacturing an idea that I believe becomes a truth mm-hmm. and that physically impacts me. And the first time I recognized this when I was 9, 10 years old, I guess I watched Lean on Me one too many times, and I developed a sense that school was a dangerous place.
Wow.
And then I watched, you know, movies. I watched the movie Big. You know mm-hmm. the movie Big.
Hanks?
Yeah, Hanks, legend. Nominated for Best Actor for that.
Yeah.
Didn't win.
Yeah.
Robbed.
You learn to not go anywhere near a Zoltar machine.
Don't go near a Zoltar machine. Like if I go to a carnival, I'm gonna grow up and get huge. Like that's not my, it's not on my bingo card.
That.
Yeah, I don't want that. But I learned that cities are scary. So between 10, 11 years old, fifth, sixth grade, I didn't sleep on a Sunday night because I was so scared of what was gonna happen at, you know, Selwyn Elementary School. This isn't exactly East Side High. And I was afraid of the world and my academics suffered. And like I said, I didn't sleep. It was really bad. And that was a traumatic period of my life. And then I had a change of scenery, went to a different school, the one we went to, just sort of pushed it all aside and said, that was a fluke. That could never happen again. And sure enough, later in life and came back in different forms, that details are silly, won't go into too much of them, but to overcome these false thoughts that I had and to distract myself, it became a matter of achieving at work or traveling, doing exciting things, drinking. You know, one way to cover up the shame you have of what you may or may not have done after a big night out is to drink and forget about it.
Yeah.
Do more.
Yeah.
Yeah, just do more. Just cover keep sweeping the dirt over the dirt.
Mm-hmm.
And that lasted a very long time until it came crashing down. It was kind of a house of cards. And I realized that, you know, that date I was talking about, I was driving a car and said, I'm not me anymore. I've completely lost grip on reality. I've let down so many people in my life that was the moment. But I worked a job that I loved, and shout out to that job. They know who they are. For 10 years, I was in management consulting. And it's part of my identity now. It's a very tough industry, but it comes with lots of promotions. So you constantly are getting feedback, promotions, and you're being told, you're good, you're good, you're good. You suck at that, but you're good. And then you keep getting told more and more as you get higher and higher. They tell you more about how you suck versus how good you are. And this is something that I've learned in the business world of the higher you move up and the more you get paid, the less kid gloves happen to you.
More criticism.
Right.
Less pampering.
Right. So criticism, which is not something anybody really loves, and I certainly do not, came more often with the pressure got higher.
Yeah.
So how do you forget about that? You travel, you go to concerts, you go, you drink, you this, you know, you do lots of different things. But yeah, I was just, all of it built up, and it was a cumulative build.
Yeah.
Did you feel it coming? Like, I mean, is this something that you were aware of, that you were like, this is not going to end well? Or like, I mean, I know you say that, like, you know, you sweep the dirt over the dirt. I mean, I'm sure there was some awareness of that, but like, did you think it was going to end the way that it ended? Or did you think that you were going to like, and just.
Yeah. There were a few sort of, it's like the volcano eruption. You got the little ones. It's like, oh, there was a little problem there.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few near miss traumas. There's one that happened in August of 2021. I had this big, stupid, fast race car type of car. And I was golfing with some friends, and it was, you know, inside of a private, you know, country club thing. And we had lots of beers on the course, and I drove back to the house where we were staying, and was like, oh, this is fine. No big deal. Not a problem. Lost control of that car, and it knocked over a lamppost inside the thing.
Mm-hmm.
The golf club?
Yep.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh my gosh, gotta just race home. So the car was limping back to the house where we were staying. It was like, great, we're good. A few hours later, cop knocks on the door.
Oh God.
And like, hey, you were seen leaving this scene, whatever. And I was like, right then and there, my life is over.
Yeah.
This is going to be a DUI. This is going to be this, that, and the other.
Feeling unsafe.
But they couldn't do anything about it. And I felt like, because they didn't know what had been going on between that point and where I was then. And that should have been the moment.
Mm.
But you know how you overcome the shame of that?
You drink.
Keep going.
More stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just more stuff. Mm. And yeah, I knew people saw it. And, you know, this is another theme of mine now is, if you see somebody going through something, you're never going to regret asking, like, dude, you got this?
Yeah.
They may come back at you and say, like, what do you, like, stop it. You're being weird.
Yeah, fine.
Yeah, but you'd rather.
They are going to say that,
yeah,
by the
way. Yeah,
of course.
Yeah, like, bro.
Yeah.
Get out of my shorts.
I'm good.
I'd much rather hear that than hear later that somebody did something really, really bad.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I didn't think it was going to lead me to where I went, but I'm so glad it did.
Yeah.
So interesting, the experience you had fifth or sixth grade, you said?
The sixth grade.
I mean, that is the definition of anxiety.
Right.
Essentially irrational fears.
Irrational fears.
Right?
Yep.
And you had, I mean, a full-blown probable disorder at that age.
In 1990 in Myers Park in Charlotte, we weren't talking about that stuff.
No. We weren't.
No.
Did you ever go to like a therapist back then or a psychiatrist, or there was no intervention?
There was, and shout out to my mom and my late father. Nobody knew. Yeah. And I just could not express. I couldn't talk about these thoughts that were in my head, and nobody could tell me that's not true anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It still happens today, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
I will concoct a catastrophe that's awaiting for me around the corner. Like, my current version is, oh, man, is the IRS going to come get me for something that I reported on my taxes last year, and then I sweat for an hour?
Yeah.
It still happens, but now it's more about healthy ways to manage that and say, you know, feelings aren't facts. Talk to yourself like a friend. Like,
yeah, a lot of tools.
Speak logic into yourself.
Yeah.
It's tough, though. It's very tough because it's a visceral, physical reaction that you feel that often perpetuates it.
Yes.
Like, you know, for me, I have the physical, like, I'm going to throw up in front of all these people. And I start to feel it, and then all of a sudden I'm getting ready to throw up, you know, because it's like, oh shit.
He usually does it before every episode.
Yeah.
No, you do it anytime you want right now. Use the book.
Excuse me, please.
Yeah, pardon me while I. It's it is a weird thing. Our brains are can be our greatest asset and our greatest enemy.
Yeah.
And
powerful.
It's yeah, it's it sucks. And I think that's something that people sometimes don't get it. And I don't understand the addiction journey because I was a heavy alcohol user, but could stop any time. I just enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that from what I and many others experienced, there is a physical element to it. There's a physical pain in your stomach. And you do anything to get rid of it.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
It sucks.
Yeah.
So when we talk about, you know, family members and friends, and I love that example of, you know, a different way of saying, okay, you good.
Yeah.
So where was it for you, man? Like, I mean, I know from what I've read in the book that your sister played a big role in kind of helping you get where you needed to go. But, like, what was kind of the turning point, or where was that, you know, kind of insight or aha moment that really, you know, had you decide to ask for help?
I was driving from Charlotte to Chapel Hill, and I had just gotten a phone call that put a lot of anxiety and, you know, fear and some shame and some just, oh, my gosh, doesn't matter what that phone call was. That was the moment that I decided. And I made a plan. I was driving a rented Ford Mustang. And I know that stretch of I-85 mm-hmm. very, very well. And I knew where I could take care of business. Little south. Little south. Yeah. So I knew where that could happen. And I thought about my mom and I thought about my sister. And, you know, I called my mom and she gave me some reassurance. Just let's talk it out. And then I went back to Charlotte the next day after I had a meeting in Chapel Hill, which I remember just sweating my way through that entire meeting and literally physically shaking. And I went home to Charlotte. My mom, you know, was soothing me and I was, you know, sitting in the fetal position on a bed in her house and thinking, yeah, I'm probably the only 42-year-old senior executive of a multi-billion-dollar corporation who's, you know, curled up in a ball
with his mom shaking, scratching with his back. Mom,
you know, maybe. Soothing. Maybe. I don't know. But my mom took amazing care of me. And then I went to the Final Four. That was a crazy thing to do. Went back to Tampa and I called my sister and said, I need you here. And we had this interesting moment. I picked her up from the airport and we almost at the same time said, I've got to do something. You've got to do something. We have to do something.
Yeah.
And that was when we both sort of said, you got to go take a break from life and you've got to really square yourself out because this is not going to sustain. So we did some quick research and got me to the place that I went, but she escorted me down there. She checked me in. There's a whole different set of things we could talk about checking into
another part of the story.
Yeah, good.
Where
yeah.
That made me chuckle.
Holy
was you walking
cow.
Into the, it's bathroom.
Well, I just
dude, that had me fucking dying.
She escorts me to this place. It's a few states west. We fly, and you know, she's getting me through the airport. Get the rental car, and I rented the car in my name so that I could control what time we got there. So we must have driven, you know, 50 miles to get the 5 miles to the place where I went. I was like, oh wait, I forgot something. Stop at the CVS. Wait, stop at Publix.
Yep.
Finally went in there and we just sort of laughed. She's like, well, okay, this is the last time you're going to hear music for a while, maybe. What do you want to listen to? And we listened to Everlong by Foo Fighters. Mm. It's our favorite.
It's a beauty.
Our favorite song. And then I was like, we can't pass up this opportunity. As we drive into this place, we listen to Crazy Train.
Oh, yeah. Oh God.
Yeah.
Had to.
We had to. We had to laugh about it.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, the intake process involves a breathalyzer, a man that tells you all the worst things you've ever heard in your life,
mm-hmm.
asks you to retell your story for the 15th time already.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, there's a moment you sign your guardianship effectively over to other human adults.
Was there a point during like that, you know, first week or so or first few days where you felt like an overwhelming like sense of safety or grace or peace. It was like, thank God I did, got here, did this, or.
Yeah, the first feeling you have is like walking into the cafeteria on the first day at a new school. Mm-hmm. I happened to walk in right when all the people that were in my, you know, unit, as we called it, were having their daily meeting. And so everyone just swivels their head over to evaluate.
Newbie.
Who's this guy? Yeah. What's he in for? Yeah.
Fresh fish.
Fresh meat. You end up when you're on the other side, you do the same thing.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, it's part of the deal. Yeah.
Is he going to be cool? Is he going to play basketball with us?
Yeah. My future ex-husband.
Yeah, it's quite a thing. But yeah, a couple days in, so the first 2 days felt like 2 weeks. But I was thinking about it last night. What's the way to describe the feeling? Some people say it's demeaning and humiliating and, you know, really negative feelings about being told that you can't do stuff. Like,
yeah,
you can't go over there. This door is locked. I found it to be a necessarily deep, humbling experience.
Yeah.
Where all the luxuries are taken away from you. All of your rights to do things are taken away from you. But the sense of safety and order and nothing's going to happen to me, it might be annoying, but man, this is comfortable. And I kept journals the whole time. Some of them are printed in the book, but starts out, these are not my people. I shouldn't be here. Mm-hmm. This is horrible. This is going to be a stain on my life forever. And then 3 days later, this is where I need to be. It's kind of sucks, but this is where I need to be. These are great people and I'm going to get a lot out of this. And I'm so fortunate to have the opportunity, the time, the resources, the recognition that I needed to do it.
How long were you there?
Came up to 39 days.
Yeah. I remember that's how I felt too. I felt like, God, this is, I could finally like rest. It was like, it's over. Like that chapter of my life was
the battle.
It was just done, and I could actually take a breath.
Well, the interesting thing you said, you know, you being told that you can't do certain things and that kind of thing, for people like us, it sounds like when I say us, I certainly can relate in that I don't do really well with full freedom.
Yeah.
Like, I am a my devices take over. You know, and I often read books about discipline and self-discipline, and there's actually a book called Discipline Equals Freedom. You may know it, Jocko Willink. But
I don't read books, dude.
Right. Well,
yeah, I don't.
I listen.
Yeah. Okay, there you go.
But it's around the same concept where once you do have some containment and, discipline is obviously self-instilled, but same idea that once it's there and you don't have all of this, you can do whatever you want, it gives you a feeling of freedom.
Well, it's interesting, too, because one of the hardest story to tell about that late 80s time, that when my parents got divorced in 86, 87, my sister and I were given a lot of freedom to operate in the world, which I know is not super unusual for kids of the 80s. We had the typical be on your bikes and don't come home until the lights come on, whatever. But we also had a lot of freedom to operate what we watched, what we did. We, even growing up, we never had curfews. And it was a combination of my mom trusted us, maybe too much. My dad was in Florida. There really weren't a lot of regulations on our lives.
Mm-hmm.
So it probably means I watched Dirty Dancing like a few too many times in, age 7, which is great. Great movie. Oh, don't get me wrong.
Please.
But, comparing that to the feeling I had when I was locked behind doors and told what I couldn't do, that feeling of what I couldn't do, I felt so loved and cared for that people considered my well-being important enough to restrict my movement. And of course, my mom loves me and loved me and was, did the best she could with the disorder that I had and all of that. But I really embraced it. I embraced not being able to do things. It took a couple days.
Yeah.
There's a real sense of safety and emotion around that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I resonate with everything you just said, man. I was the same way.
Mm-hmm.
divorced parents, both working.
Yeah.
Tons of freedom, no curfew.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
And then the, you know, it's interesting when, and I speak about discipline a lot because the, my experience to this day, if I do one thing I don't want to do, if I make myself do something, one thing I don't want to do, I feel phenomenal. And it's the same idea. It's like
yeah.
that feeling of just kind of containment and discipline. And you don't, you can't just live life carefree. You've yeah. got to care and you've got to have some level of what my dad used to call it. God, I hated that word. We got to have some parameters.
There you go. Yeah.
Hated
it. Put rails around this thing.
Oh, exactly. But when you do it to yourself, it just gives you the sense of like some control, really. Yeah. So, control.
And that was something that it goes back to the country day schedule thing.
Mm-hmm.
Every day we had these little cubby holes and we get our schedule and it was, you have to be here. And you got to do this thing. When I came home and I didn't have it, I realized I needed to recreate that quickly. So I created a daily schedule. It was a weekly grid. And then each day had its things.
Mm-hmm.
I abandoned that after a little while. That was a little restrictive. But to this day, I have a list of 5 things that I have to do every day and 5 things that I should do every day. And I will tell you, if you'll humor me,
yeah.
what are those things? In order, time with God, get out of bed, shower, take my medications, leave the house. Those are 5 things I have to do every day. And if I don't, something's been wrong. To the point that I will not shower all day if it's just been one of those days working from home, whatever, that before I get in bed at 11:30 at night, I will shower because I got to check that list. Well, right. I mean, there's nobody else in that bed, so who would know? It's fine. And then the 5 things that I should do every day is they're a little more frivolous. Drink a lot of water. Work on a personal project. Whatever that may be.
What does that mean?
Means I had a project going on of acquiring a golf cart.
Oh, nice.
I had a project going on of digitizing our family photos. At any time, there's a project. At one time, it was the book.
Yeah.
Do some writing.
Sure.
The third thing is a real workout. Like, actually get my heart rate to 150.
Trickle of sweat.
Mm-hmm. Get a trickle of sweat. That counts. Check the box. Do something book-related. So try to get the word out there, do something on social media, whatever. And I sort of lost count of all of them. That might have been 5. I don't know.
Yeah.
But those things I have to do every day, and I don't have to do those. I want to do those. But like you said, I force myself to do things I don't want to do. Yeah. And oftentimes that includes going to my therapy session.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Some days it's get out of bed. Right?
Absolutely, which is why there's those 5.
Yeah.
I don't want to get out of bed today, but you have to.
Yeah. Yeah.
How important has therapy been for you in your journey? Because I tell everybody to go.
Yeah.
It's been so good for me over the years.
I mean, to me, it's like stretching.
Yeah.
It's like you may not be a hardcore athlete, but stretching benefits everybody.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first thing I did. So before I had the big one, I started going to a therapist. And I remember just thinking, like, this is so wrong. And there's, like, a couch.
Yeah.
Like, what do I do? Do I lay down? And then here comes this
Can
guy.
Can I sit
Wait,
on
do
it?
I sit? Like, what do I do with my hands? And then there's this guy that walks in, looks like he's from Central Casting. He's got a big sweater and a big beard. And I'm like, okay. So he started talking to me and spilling everything. Okay, session's over. That happens 4 times. And then at the end of the 4th visit, he's like, it sounds like you've recreated your family of origin at your workplace and that you have emotions attached to your work and your achievements because you don't want to let down those people, because if you're letting down those people, you're letting down your father, your mother, and your sister. Mm-hmm. Like, son of a
bam.
Yeah.
Woo. Mic drop.
Thank you.
Thank you. So that was the moment that I believed in it, and I've been consistently going, for a long time. But I'll tell you, when you're in an inpatient experience, it is nonstop. I mean, it's more of an interrogation.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
It's hard to do therapy and treatment.
Well, here's a question that I have. So when we were at the place I went, we talked about how we were almost jealous of people who just had substance issues.
Nobody just has substance, but I
understand that. No, but that's what I've learned since then. Yeah. It's the substance is the symptom, not the disease. But it seems like there's been, you know, since the 70s, 80s of origins of AA and whatnot, there's been much more of a mental health component to substance, which is great.
Yeah.
Because for us, substances might have been something completely different. It wasn't a literal drug or alcohol, but
yeah,
that's something that I hope people understand when they see even like the wacky homeless person on the side of the road or someone close to them that's got an alcohol problem, that there's a lot of symptoms, but there's a real underlying problem.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're getting there. I mean, I think we're having the right conversations. We're headed in the right direction. I mean, it's all the same shit. We're all trying to mask our pain. You know, I mean, that's what all the mental health symptoms are, the same thing. You know?
Yeah.
It's just, we just cope with things differently.
You know, but there's this public view of it, and call it public or call it private, and I noticed this about myself when Matthew Perry went through what he went through. I work less in this field now, but there was a period of time where I was working constantly in this field and very compassionate, very empathetic, very understanding that people are the way they are for reasons. And I need to be, you know, sensitive to that and understanding to that. And just because they went and did this thing, I don't have a right to be super angry at that thing because there's this big, long line of reasoning of what led to it. And then Matthew Perry comes out, and I am so pissed at that guy. I'm like, you're a fucking liar. You're a cheater. You treat people like fucking shit. And that was my reaction to him. And then he's talking about helping all these people. And then it turns out he was completely lying. And then he dies from the fucking thing. And I'm just angry at the guy. And I'm like, man, that's what the public feels.
Yeah.
That's what they think, is they just have an emotional reaction to these people. And they don't find that sensitivity and that compassion and that empathy. Because there's a reason he was that way. I have no right to be mad at that. I should treat him the same way I treat everybody else. And of course, I'm over that now. That was just my initial reaction. But that's an example of the way people think, like family members, angry. Just, why would you do that?
That's also a mental health symptom.
Sure.
You know, I mean, and that's the point, and that's the thing that people don't understand, is like they're just masking their own pain. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
And until we understand that, you know, that we're all human, and that the human condition and human suffering is underneath all this stuff, and we're all just doing our best to try to cope with it. And some of us, you know, we cross the line, you know, and some people figure it out. They find semi-functional or functional ways to deal with it. And, you know, those are, I guess, the lucky ones, the guys. But then again, I think about it even deeper, and you know, I think about where I would have been if I didn't have my addiction issues. You know, I'd have about a tenth of the self-awareness that I do today. I'd probably be working at the, you know, no offense to bankers, I'd probably be working at a bank, you know, married to a woman that I don't love, you know, drinking 4 or 5 drinks a night, you know, not interacting with my kids as much as I should.
Yeah.
And thinking that everything's okay, because that's what we all do.
Yeah.
You know? And have no idea that what's going on with me is actually, I have some unaddressed mental and emotional health problems.
Mm-hmm.
I use an analogy of like, if I got a scratch, if anybody gets a scratch on their arm, all right, there's the scratch. Sometimes a Band-Aid is enough to, you know, fix that up. You're fine. Sometimes it's deep enough, you got to get stitches. Sometimes it gets, you know, infected and gross, and you got to take antibiotics. And sometimes it's just so bad, the rest of you is going to die, and you have to amputate your arm. All right. If you first get a scratch, I don't recommend the first thing you do to amputate your arm, right? You go through steps. And I feel like those of us who have gone into more of the, you know, if the Band-Aid is talking to somebody, just a friend, if the stitches are going to therapy, if the antibiotics are taking an SSRI or whatever we take, and then if amputation is going to an inpatient treatment facility, there are those of us who go all the way to the amputation part that probably has a stigma on it. And I'm sure there's people who see me, who see that this is happening, who talk to you, who know your story. There is judgment that comes from it.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a weird irony that those of us who are more public about it, I'm not saying you or me, but even Matthew Perry, he went public with it. And there's this human nature of you want to see them fall again.
Yeah.
It's really unfortunate. But just rewinding it back, everybody should be thinking about what's the Band-Aid that I need? What's the asking somebody for help? And I think that would help build empathy to those who did have to take a much bigger step.
For sure.
The Matthew Perry thing is such a good example, though, of when people go public with something they struggle with, the judgment almost gets higher.
Yeah.
Versus somebody who's just an asshole and doesn't talk about how they have a real issue.
Right.
It's like we give those people free passes all the time. Mm-hmm. But if somebody is like, oh, no, I think we're getting better about it. But historically, that's the way it's been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is why a lot of people in my life said it was crazy to write a book about this, especially if I'm trying to still be in the business world.
And if you choose not to interact with me as a result, then I don't want to interact with people like that.
No, I'm not ashamed by anything. I think I'm a better person today than I was 2 years ago. And that's why I am. So it's all good.
Yeah.
That's all that matters.
Yeah. I mean, I could talk about this for days, man. And I was talking about four students with you earlier. I still don't understand why kids are not taught like developmental psychology in middle school. Where we understand some of this stuff, or we have like a baseline of what mental and emotional health actually looks like. So at least we have a target to aim at, or like some kind of model to look at and be like, oh, well, that doesn't really look like what's going on with me, so I might want to look at some of this shit. Like, we don't have that anywhere.
I believe to graduate high school, you should have to learn what a budget is.
Yeah.
Learn how to do laundry. Mm-hmm. Learn the basics of cooking and preparing meals for yourself or something like that.
Yeah, how a stove works.
Yeah. And then general health stuff, mental and physical. So here's how to identify, moments of stress or something like that. And here's some things to cope. If you have a terrible headache for an extended period of time, go to the doctor. Basic stuff. But the mental health part that you just said, I agree. Everyone should know this is why this happens, and it's normal.
We have enough, evidence and empirical data to where we have a good map of, like, what our brain looks like and what's going on. But there's just, and I think this is another reason why there's not a lot of empathy and a lot of misconceptions around stuff like we've gone through. Is that people just don't have access to it. It's not common knowledge. There isn't any kind of basic understanding of what this looks like. It baffles me sometimes.
Yeah, and I was excited to see, I was telling y'all earlier, I went to our high school a few days ago, and the level of awareness they have at that school and the resources they have, that's great. That's a private school. That's something with a lot of resources, but it would be amazing to see this spread more to public school system and across neighborhoods and across cities, because this is one topic that does not discriminate.
Yeah, for sure. And it's going to take guys like you that have been successful, that came from good families, came from good schools, that crushed it in corporate America, and you weren't, you were still vulnerable. And
yeah. Can I ask you a question again, or both of you guys a question? Rules and regulations inside of facilities. We were not allowed drawstrings. Yeah. We were not allowed any cords of any sort.
Mm-hmm.
Shoelaces. Is this all the same at other types of places?
No, I mean, that's usually for primary mental health facilities. Yeah. They'll do that. Anytime there's a significant risk of self-harm, they'll do that. At most, I mean, they should do it everywhere, probably, these days. But yeah, I mean, usually it, for primary substance use disorder treatment programs, I don't think that's a...
Yeah, it was a real pain.
Yeah.
I had to take the drawstrings out of several pairs of Lululemon shorts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And those things are not made.
God, what a bummer.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I ruined perfectly good shorts. Yeah, you know, it's a really good
Lulus. I usually
Lulus.
Just like drop french fries on mine and then it leaves a big ass like oil stain.
Yeah.
That's how mine get destroyed.
That's fine too. But yeah, I had to wear some Vans. We didn't have shower curtains.
The checkered ones?
I did not get the checkered ones. I got some Carolina blue ones just to, you know, represent.
Of course.
There's just some weird stuff in there. The weirdest part, so in the state where I was, you have to get visible
mm-hmm.
check.
15 minutes, 30 minutes?
15 minutes. That includes while you're sleeping.
Yeah.
It's...
Well, they just came out. A buddy of mine is I don't know, it's something to do with this new digital health company, and they just came out with an infrared scanner that nurses can use now to come in and they scan you so they can check your vitals without interrupting your sleep.
Yeah, luckily we didn't have to do the vitals check during sleep. We had to do it every morning and night.
Yeah, I saw the thing where they put the towel in the door.
We had to shove the towel between the door and the wall. Yeah, it's...
So the door didn't slam?
Yeah, exactly. And you learn how to sleep, like, back to the door. it's a whole thing. There are also some funny rules that you couldn't... There was no, you know, romance of any mm-hmm. sort. You cannot canoodle.
No fraternizing.
No fraternizing, which is funny to me. Like, if anybody's getting, you know, trying to run game...
Yeah.
While you're in a place like that, like...
In a gown.
I'll tell you what. Tell you what they're going to find attractive about me is that I'm in the same mental health facility that they are.
Yeah,
so,
right. That's right.
Fish in a barrel.
You'd be surprised
how many times.
Oh, God.
But if there's rules there, it means it had to have been for a reason. Something had to have happened before.
Oh,
I was like,
yeah.
I cannot imagine this.
Well, and substance abuse treatment places, I mean, there's not a whole lot of crossover of men and women, but there is.
I
remember, and bear with me here, but when I was at Hazelden in Minnesota, we would have, you know, there's like an auditorium and we'd go hear a speaker 3 days a week. And that was the only time that the women's facility would join us.
Mixer.
And there was this one female we just happened to catch eyes one time. And so every single time we went in there, you look back, mm-hmm. see, do one of these. And that was all I needed.
You didn't hear shit from the speaker.
Right. Yeah, you were really locked in to what that speaker was telling
Big
you.
Big time.
That's great.
You also couldn't take like a stick deodorant. Because they'd wrap it up in toilet paper, squeeze the alcohol out of it, and drink it.
Wow.
Yeah, there's lots of ways to get alcohol.
Yeah, never thought about that one.
Yeah, somebody did that.
Yeah, somebody clearly did that. Yeah, amazing.
Other than your 5 and 5, what else are you doing, man? Like, where, in terms of changes that you've made in your daily discipline or daily life or and maybe some new like insights that you think about every day, like what's different now that you're kind of in, I mean, I don't, you might not use the word recovery, but like mental health recovery.
Yeah, I consider that.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of small just day-to-day tools that I use. My favorite one I've mentioned before is talk to yourself like you talk to a friend.
Mm-hmm.
I have little tattoos on my thumbs here. Two things I live by. One is it's this little 1/1, and it means make one decision at a time, one day at a time.
Nice.
It means I can't redo yesterday's decisions and I can't borrow tomorrow's decisions. So just make the next best one and stop beating yourself up or worrying about what's next. On the other side, it's a KP for keep pounding. Which okay, so first of all, if you're not a Charlotte person,
fucking loyal, dude.
If you're hold on,
loyal.
If you're not a Charlotte person, that is what the Carolina Panthers mantra is. But when I was in the facility, we had arts and crafts class or whatever, and one day I went once because that was the craziest I ever felt, like sitting there watching people use popsicle sticks and paste. That was one step too far for me.
Mm-hmm.
So.
This is not for me.
Art therapy
this is
not
for me.
Forte.
This is not for me. Music therapy was cool, but the art, no. I made a bracelet that said keep pounding, mainly because I just, you know, missed football. And it also was a reminder of, yeah, like you're on your ass right now, but keep get back up. Just keep going. As weirdly sexual as keep pounding sounds, unfortunately, that's going to forever be on my hand, but that's why I didn't write the whole thing out. That might worry some people.
Just keep pounding,
just keep
man.
Pounding in all things. Just don't let anything stop you. So yeah, there's some of those sort of mantras that I have. One little tip that I use, and I don't think this is even what you're asking of, like little day-to-day tips. I'll get to the bigger one in a second.
Yeah, no, keep going.
Something I learned a lot, something I learned and I did a lot when I was there is when I start to ramp up and start to get these irrational things, count things in the room.
Yeah.
Just
good mindfulness practice.
Yeah, good mindfulness. So I use that all the time. But in general, the biggest thing for me is think a few steps ahead. And the power of the pause is something we learned about and put into place. Whether it's you saying something, whether it's you drinking something that, you know, maybe more than you should, if it's writing an email to somebody, just thinking about, I may kick some pain down the road if I go drink 10 drinks tonight, but that pain will be waiting for me twice the
twofold size.
Yeah,
pay the
tomorrow.
Paper, man.
Yeah, eventually that happens, and so I'm much more thoughtful about that. And then on the drinking side, I went no drinks for 6 months, and it was like the best. I mean, you know the benefits of this. Yeah. It's amazing. So I reframed my relationship with alcohol big time, and now I drink some, but I track it. I have an app that tracks every drink. It makes you realize, like, wow, are you really giving away that many dollars and calories and, like, brain cells?
Yeah. And good sleep?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I track all things in my life now, like my Excel of all the five and five. And I remember the fifth one's play guitar.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah.
Is that a new thing?
It's a new thing.
Yeah, I didn't.
I know like six chords, bro.
It's hard, man. It's such a hard thing to learn.
Six chords. Yeah. Well, you asked a guest recently what intimidates you, and I was like, oh, the guitar.
Yeah.
Music in general.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's fun.
So, dude, what's next, man? Like, where are we going?
Hollywood, bro. Hollywood. It's time to shop this thing out.
Hell yeah.
See if Chris Pratt's available. I'm sure he's out there somewhere listening. No, the real answer is I'll break it down for life, career, and this project. Yeah. Life is just be super mindful of all decisions that I'm making and never, ever get back anywhere close to where I was before. Some of that means do I need to make a geographical change? Do I need to leave? I live in Tampa, Florida, so do I need to come back to Charlotte? Do I need to be closer to home? Atlanta, where my sister is? I don't know. I'm taking it a day at a time. One decision at a time, one day at a time.
Charlotte.
I can't say this because my mom will like freak out, and if she listens to this, she's like, when are you moving to Charlotte?
Yeah, you said you were moving
to Charlotte. Where are you? That's not her voice. That's not how she sounds at all.
No, she doesn't.
She actually has a lovely
voice. Well, I'm going to call her and we can start conspiring.
A lovely voice. All right, so that's life. Career, I'm still, you know, still working hard, still trying to climb. And on the book project, it's just every single day trying to get the message out to one more person. The book available on Amazon, Target, and BarnesandNoble.com. Trying to, you know, just get exposure for it. And it's little by little. I mean, what I'm doing after this is I know of a few of those little, those little neighborhood book shelf things. Like, you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the little house.
You're going to take all the books out and just fill them with
yours? I'm going to take all the books out, throw them away, and put mine in there. And I'm going to put one of mine in there.
Yeah.
And just, you know.
Dude, that's awesome.
Just, yeah, but like sideways. So it covers all the other ones.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just about getting the message out, and I've had a couple of speaking engagements, and that's really what I'm excited about is the idea of getting out there live, talking in front of people that are corporate audiences, whatever.
It's fun, man.
That's what I'd love to do. Yeah,
you know, you and I didn't really know each other.
No, she knew my sister.
I grew up with your sister. I've known your sister my whole life. She's been a friend of mine my whole life. She's a delightful gal, as is your mother. I mean, Charlotte people, we all know your mom.
Yeah.
Interestingly, I sat behind you three rows in the garden at the Heels game 2 years ago, where we hit the last second shot to go into overtime.
Yeah. There's a fantastic photo I have of that.
You were with a big crew, mm-hmm. right there in the end zone.
Mm-hmm.
I was three rows behind you, and I kept seeing you because you were blocking me, because y'all would all stand up a lot. And I just, something about your face, like either I'd seen you, but obviously we've crossed paths somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
But I recognized you, didn't know really who you were. I even think I took a picture of you and was like, who is this dude?
Funny.
To somebody. And then when I started to kind of see you more based on the book and, of course, coming on here, I was like, that's that face. That's that guy. Who that is.
That's that guy.
That's the dude.
Yeah. Yeah, and at the time, I had very long hair.
You did,
because
I remember.
Love Bruce Springsteen, the song Dancing in the Dark. It's, you know, one of the big hits, but it's actually my favorite lyrically. It's one of my favorite songs. And there's a part in there, it's, it says, I want to change my clothes, my hair, my face.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually got rid of a lot of clothes that I wore in the old life. Got rid of all of my shoes.
Oof, that's you're a shoe guy?
No.
He's a shoe guy.
Well, that would be hard for you. I like your shoes. They're lovely.
I've got them in front of the camera the whole show.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Well, I've got a few, you know, good ones. But it was like my crappy, you know, Brooks, whatever. Got rid of them. I just wanted new shoes. Face part, I didn't get a face tat or anything. That's fine. But the hair part, I was like, you know what? I'm not going to cut my hair. And I didn't cut my hair for about a year. So from the time I went in until, I think it was like 11 months later, never got a haircut. And it was some...
Was it like long?
Yeah, it was like, I mean, it was horrible.
it's very long.
Shout out to all women who have long hair. I don't know how you do it. It's hot. Like it's like, I don't mean like sexy. I mean like hot, it's hot.
Neck.
Like hot neck. And I sweat a lot anyway, so it was terrible. But yeah, I thought, I was like, I want an outward sign of change.
Mm-hmm.
And people were like, can you choose a different one? Because that one sucks. So eventually I cut it. But yeah. Little weird things we do.
Awesome.
No, oh, yeah.
All right, Brother Michael, thank you.
Thank you for having me. This is awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you, dude.
Sir. Good stuff.